Welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new or returning listeners, you may know that you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and also on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And in this latest episode, I have another debut. It's so funny. It's back-to-back debuts, and there's going to be another debut later coming up. I'm really excited to introduce Yishun Lai, who is the author of Not a Self-Help Book, The Misadventures of Marty Wu, which is coming out, or is it? It's coming out, right?
It is coming out. Official publication date is May 6th.
May 6th from Shade Mountain Press, and we are both Shade Mountain Press authors. I'm a contributor. You have the full-length book. I have a little piece of an anthology with Shade Mountain Press, which is a wonderful independent feminist press that does about, I believe, Rosalie does about two titles a year, yes?
Two titles a year. Right now she's down to one because she's trying to really concentrate hard on making sure that those publications get their due, which is great.
Yeah. And she does a really great job. I mean, she works on it from soup to nuts. And the typesetting is solid. Me being a typesetter, I'm like, it's legit typesetting. So it's okay.
Yeah, and we have an excellent graphic designer as well, Robin Park, who is also a Shade Mountain author. So it's definitely a community effort, but it's also due to great authors like yourself. So thanks so much for making sure people know about that press.
Oh, no problem. I do what I can, and it's great to have indie small pub people on too, because you know the glitz and the glamour always goes to trade. You know, Big Five. As we're recording, the Pulitzers were announced today, and pretty much they were all well-known entities.
Yes,
except
they
for
really
poetry,
are.
Which is usually big pub, big five. But yeah, I mean, Grove Atlantic is pretty small, actually, but they're not.
Atlantic is, yeah. But
they're kind of mid-level. Yeah.
Hunting down the voices that so few people will ever see. So I'm pleased to support them and pleased to see that they're doing so well.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's great to have, and there's an abundance of them, and I hope to do an episode on that later in terms of the indie publishing market that people do know about but don't know about as well and all that stuff. And I'm sure we can talk more about it in terms of what your experiences were with Not a Self-Help Book in terms of the soup to nuts, and a lot of what in the previous episode Leland Chuck had mentioned about how collaborative it was, because he was working with basically five people.
Right.
Yeah. So, but the first question always is, how did you get into this industry? Not only are you an author, you're a writer, you're an editor, you're editor for a lit magazine, Tahoma Literary Review, and you're also a consultant, and you've been doing this for a while.
Like your resume. This is where we go to the part where I lie about my age. No, I'm kidding. I've been doing this for over 20 years now. Mm-hmm. I could be really generous and say that it started when I was in high school. I think that might be part of the truth. I think the idea that you kind of know where you want to be in life and what you want to work with early isn't a joke, right? There's this sort of gut instinct about where you want to be. And there's a little story that's told in my family where when I was seven, I was turning the pages of Vogue magazine, and I lit upon a masthead. And I said to my mom, I want to be on this thing one day. What is this thing called? And she's like, oh, you can't make a living out of writing. That's never going to happen. And I was like, okay, well, what do I do with this? But you know, guess what? You can make a living out of writing. And, it just happened to be something that is just such a key part of my life. I love words. Even if I'm not fluent in what some people would refer to as my home language. So clearly I'm fluent in English, and this is the language I chose to write in. So for me, working with words has always been one of those things that is kind of at the top of my list. And there was a time in college where I was considering going into a law degree, but I sort of justified that by saying that I would still be working with words, right, in some way, shape, or form. But then shortly afterwards, I got into writing advertising copy for the legendary J. Peterman catalog.
Oh, wow.
If you've ever watched Seinfeld?
Yes, I did.
Okay, right. So I was Elaine before Elaine was Elaine. I worked for catalog companies for some time while I was actually in the advertising world, mm-hmm. and then branched out and became an editor and a freelance writer, and that's where I stayed pretty much. So,
well, did you finish law school or no? You left.
No, I never, I didn't actually go to law school. Basically what happened was I took the LSAT, and I think what happened is, I'm only telling you the way I remember it. They do say that when you remember things, you're not actually remembering the event, you're remembering the last time you remembered it. So this is probably some kind of weird fabrication that I've made about myself. But I kind of remember sitting in the chair, filling out the LSAT, and just being like, I just can't do it anymore. And like starting halfway through the test, it was like C, like in the multiple choices. I just started filling out C's all the way down, and then I just kind of left the exam. So I never did make it to law school. I'm totally okay with that. My brother's an attorney. I think that's close enough for me. but yeah, it was definitely one of those things where I always knew I wanted to work with words. So I guess I was lucky.
Well, also, when you said it seemed to start in high school, even though you gave us the anecdote of a younger self admiring the masthead in Vogue, and I love that it's Vogue.
Right, I know.
I was surrounded by Jet magazines as a child.
Oh, sweet. That's a good choice.
And in my high school, there was actually a focus. I mean, I don't know if in your high school, but I remember in my high school, you can actually kind of have majors, and my quote unquote major was writing.
Oh, wow.
Was that a possibility for you? Was that something you were also kind of doing a stepping stone into, hey, I can actually learn more about this and maybe get a degree in this and then make it profitable?
That's fascinating, Jen. I didn't know that you could do such a thing. No, we didn't have that. I had very good literature instructors, mm-hmm. And we had a quite well-known high school newspaper that I was a part of, but I wasn't successful there. It wasn't like I was, chosen to be one of the top editors or mm-hmm. that I wrote all the time. I think that was just kind of, my brief entry into that world, like, oh, mm-hmm. this is a possibility. But honestly, I actually have to thank my mother for this, because she informed me that I could get an internship at the local newspaper. So I did that. I worked for a little publication called the Claremont Courier down here, mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed myself. And I think that was actually my first summer in college. So it would have been post-freshman year in college, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was great. It was nice to be kind of a small town newspaper correspondent, driving places and mm-hmm. visiting local personalities to write them up. And then I also got to write about my former high school graduation. So that was kind of cool. It was neat to have that lens of experience and kind of see what that was about. That's mm-hmm. also, I think, where I discovered the personal essay, because mm-hmm. that story they had me do on the high school publication, on the high school graduation, was definitely about the way I looked at it after having graduated for a year.
mm-hmm. And also, well, since you've been doing the freelance thing for about 20 years, when did that become a viable option as a career and a way to make money? Because I know for me, I do freelance and I do a full-time job.
Right.
And then I have friends who are doing the hustle, the freelance, constantly getting adjunct positions, writing here, writing there, getting these posts everywhere. And there's, this kind of dichotomy of, okay, so you have this 9-to-5 quote unquote secure job.
Right.
But that's still a time suck. And then also in the freelance life, the hustle can be such a time suck too. So when did you make that decision to say, I'm going to be a freelancer, a full-time freelancer?
You sent me this question early on, and plenty of time for me to mull this over. And the truth is, I don't think I ever said to myself, I would love to have a freelance career. Mm-hmm. I knew I kind of wanted that lifestyle. There was a period where I was like full-time freelance writer. I didn't have anchor clients. I didn't have, a place that I could go to every mm-hmm. single day for a couple of hours. I mean, I had a couple of clients here and there that would allow me to do that. Like I actually did some copy editing for the hip hop magazine Blaze. Do you remember that publication?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I copy edited for Blaze for a little bit. And then there were a couple of other publications that, that had me on for short-term contracts, but really I kind of decided that I wanted to pursue this full time after I left advertising for the second time. So I've actually had two advertising careers. Mm-hmm. And what was happening was I knew I wanted to write novels, like sort of long form fiction. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted words to kind of subsume all of my life. So mm-hmm. I thought, all right, well, why don't I try this, you know, this advertising junker for a little while. I can make a comfortable living and then quote unquote, write on the side. Mm-hmm. And that never really happens, you know? Mm. But that's when I realized that I should probably work harder at maybe doing some more work in corporate copy, which is eventually where I settled in terms of my freelance career. Mm-hmm. So that's where the consultancy comes in. And believe it or not, that's actually where I make most of my money, is in writing corporate copy and designing brand strategies for people. But that allowed me to become, quote unquote, a full-time freelancer in this corporate consulting field. And then from there, I could work on the novel if I wanted to.
Mm. So with the, you know, brain capacity of doing the corporate work, the consulting work, and also you do editing and also you're writing, yeah. You don't find it hard to switch gears?
I find that the corporate consulting gives me a break from the mess of stuff that is my gray matter. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if I can take a break from you know, swimming around in my own words and my own plot line, it makes me that much of a better writer mm-hmm. when I'm not working on the corporate stuff. So one of them informs the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what would your advice be for someone who was thinking of quitting the full-time job to do the freelance gig, not permanently, but full-time, in order to write? What would your advice be? Or really, what can be realistically expected? Because I think when people switch these gears and they say, I'm going to have all this time now, I say, there's never enough time. What are you talking about?
Right. So I used to think that there was like, I pictured my brain as being this bank of words. Okay. So say I had like a maximum withdrawal of 10,000 words a day. Okay? And then I would... Have you never imagined this for yourself?
No, I'm laughing because I'm like, yep.
Good, I'm glad.
It's solidarity. Okay, so I'm like, yep, there's but so much I can write a day.
Right, exactly. So it's like, I'm going to withdraw 5,000 words from my day job, and then I'm going to stop, you know, and then from there, I'm gonna like dedicate 5,000 words to like my personal work, whether that be essays or fiction or whatever, right? I think the answer to that question is that it's so personal, depending on who you are and what kind of person you are. I mean, I've just said that I look upon my corporate work as being a real break, right? Because there is, in corporate work, there's a certain level of turnaround where it can be so fast, where you write something and the company puts it into effect right away. And that's a beautiful thing, right? Whereas, like, as we all know, the publishing world can be absolutely so glacial. But in terms of potential advice to give people who are just starting out, I was really lucky when I decided to quit for the first time and actually be a full-time freelancer. I had a ton of contacts. At the time that I stopped working for one publication, per se, I had built up a lot of contacts and a lot of really good people who were willing to introduce me to their editors and make introductions for me. Mm-hmm. This was back in the era when you still sent queries by snail mail.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I remember
that. And this is, we're talking like magazine queries. Okay. So like, you know, 1999, 2000 or so, mm-hmm. you were still sending out like snail mail queries, and then you would include your self-addressed stamped envelope and, you know, they would send you the rejection letter, or they would email you back and say, yes, we're interested in this query. Mm-hmm. So if without those introductions, I don't know that I would have been as willing to just kind of like, you know, leave everything behind.
Yeah.
So if you don't have those contacts, I would suggest not doing it. Like, find mm-hmm. yourself an anchor client. Make sure, and I mean, just to explain anchor client, meaning that it's somebody who will pay the bills for you and who will be steady on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, find yourself an anchor client and then dedicate the rest of your life. But don't give that up. I mean, be sure that if you are going to do this kind of thing and make these excuses to yourself about, oh, well, you know, I'm going to write every day for a living, and you're gonna define writing in as broad a terminology as possible, i.e. advertising copy or social media copy or anything else that you might have on your deck, If you're going to define it that broadly, then be true to yourself and be sure that you are indeed spending some time working on the project that speaks to your heart day in and day out. If you don't do that, it's very easy to get caught up in the money-making part of work. And it's so easy to just kind of like forget that you wanted to be a novelist at the begin with, or a poet to begin with, right?
Yeah. And that's what I've seen from friends. Not all of them, but a few who were, you know, doing modeling gigs and this and that and this and that. And they're so wiped that they get home. I can't even think about writing because I don't know where my next bill is coming from. I don't know. Or I'm teaching adjuncting, and adjuncting is a lot of work too.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. I can imagine. Well, I mean, with adjuncting, like you not only have your own self to depend on, but you have all these like these pairs of wide eyes looking at you going, oh my gosh, you know, take me through this, take me through this period of writing. Like, how do I do this? Like, that's a lot of pressure, you know? So I can imagine that would be hard, but I mean, I do remember there was a time when I would work the magazine day job and be so jazzed by speaking to the writers that I was helping to edit or the writers whose manuscripts I was shepherding through the process that I would then go home and bang out a short story. And that's great and that's ideal, but you have to make sure that you are in some way, shape or form surrounding yourself with people who inspire you. I mean, I know that sounds like so Pollyanna and rose-colored glasses, but it's so important to have that in your life, right? You need to have other writers in your life, and make them other struggling writers. Other struggling writers are great to have around. You need to have your tribe around you, right?
Yeah. Yes. That is a tagline.
Exactly. Exactly.
At the time of this recording, the Vita Count has come out, and it's about 2 weeks, because I think it came out the very beginning of April, around the first, because it coincided with AWP.
Right.
And they included, the Vita Count included, sexuality, race, and disability as well. And also gender. I believe they broke it down to cisgender and those who identify as transgender as well.
Okay.
And you're a nonfiction editor for Tahoma Literary Review, as mentioned. And what have you found to be the submission rate by women, by marginalized voices? And what ways have you found to reach these audiences to get these submissions? Because we know that the biggest comment is, I can't find, where are these people?
They're
not submitting to us as though we do not exist. It's, you know.
Right. I wish people wouldn't say that, because I am so proud to tell you that of the 317 nonfiction submissions I've had over the last 5 issues, 222 of them were from women.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. And I'll piggyback on top of that and say that in each of the 1, 2, 3, 4, in each of the 5 issues that I have edited nonfiction for, we've published mostly women. In one issue, it was like 4 out of the 5 four of the 5 essays were by women.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't quite broken it down to ethnicity or race.
Can be harder to do, obviously.
But it's a little bit harder to do. But part of that is because I don't actually read the cover letters until I'm on the fence about an essay.
Oh, okay.
I don't like to bias myself too much because we do have this edict that we want to publish as diversely and as widely as possible. I'm perhaps a little bit too cautious in that I err on the side of not wanting to be biased one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So although there are times when, you know, I'll look at the queue and be like, oh my goodness gracious, this issue is so white. In terms of the nonfiction anyways, but I can't speak for my co-editors. I can say that we are publishing a lot of women, and that we do get a lot of women who submit.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of this comes down to the way in which we've worded our call for submissions. Somewhere in the what I'm looking for section that you get in every literary magazine, I have asked the writers to be brave. And I think that resonates with a lot of women. When I do get around to reading the cover letters, I actually find that a lot of people quote that back to me. And they say, stuff like, you asked me to be brave, so I'm sending you something that took me a lot of courage to write. Mm-hmm. And I think that resonates quite a bit. I'm actually quite moved by it, because I think that when you edit nonfiction, you get a little piece of somebody. Obviously, that's true for poetry and for fiction too. But a lot of times, I'll get these sort of like raw, kind of bleeding bits of work that come across my desk, and you know that these people are giving you a part of their lives, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the call to be brave has resonated quite a bit with people, and that has upped my my percentage of women who are submitting over other literary magazines, maybe. The other part of what we do at TLR is we have a hard and fast rule against solicitation. So we never solicit work from any angle of our lives. So it's very much an open queue. We call it an open queue and not a slush pile, mm-hmm. Specifically because we want to make sure that the magazine is 100% dedicated to new voices if we can.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. So I think all of that helps quite a bit.
Yeah, I agree, because when talking to many people at some of the top tier ones, I mean, Allison Wright, I believe her name is, who is one of the editors for VQR,
right.
Virginia Quarterly Review, she said about 2% of what they publish is from the slush, and they called it slush, or unsolicited submissions.
Right.
And that means most of their stuff is solicited. And when you have it's pretty much dedicated to, you know, white, I think straight. I don't want to, you know, put that in their mouths if it's not. But I have a feeling it might be, like, non-disabled. And I believe Alexander Chi was added on several months ago as an editor. And he's the kind of the spot of color. And when Allison Wright did this online discussion, I asked pointedly, because that's what I do, about what she's going to do about diversity or, you know, more inclusion. Uh-huh. And he said, you know, it's our responsibility and we have to do that too. And I'm so glad we're going to have Alexander to help us. But, you know, I'm proud. And then, you know, she rattled off a handful of names of POC writers that they've published, and I'm like, yeah, that's like six. I'm like, I'm not impressed by six. And, you know, not to make people feel bad, but in a way, yeah, make you feel bad, because it's like, I'm not impressed that you published six writers of color out of 500 non-writers of color. You know, I'm just not impressed by that.
Well,
I wonder if the solicitation is a huge part of it.
Well, maybe. I mean, you know,
based on the percentages, it sounds like.
We've all seen the Leon Lowe study that says that, what is it, like 88% of the editorial departments are white women or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to misrepresent that. So I'm telling all the podcast audience right now to go check me up on that. But it is somewhere above 80% that the publishing industry and the editorial department is white. And I think part of what we're doing at Tahoma Literary Review is also looking for diversity in subject matter. Mm-hmm. And that will loan itself, I think, to more diversity in the ranks. You know, the disability question is one that I have yet to address. I have a wonderful essay from T.K. Dalton that's about his job as a sign language translator in the schools of the Bronx. And while that's not by a disabled writer, it does open the door to writers to let them know that we're welcoming that and that we're interested in hearing from that angle of the world, right?
Yes.
And the other part of it too is that when you choose interesting stories, you are more likely to get interesting people. Mm-hmm. It seems like an obvious thing, but you know, look for the stories that might not see the light of day, right? And you might just find some great people behind them. I mean, that's the way it goes, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing we're doing is we also have a text document that's for the site challenged. So it's in large print and it's easier to read. And we also have some audio files as well that folks can listen to. So, you know, these are all things that we're doing to try and make the publication more welcoming that way. And I think it's working.
Hmm. If yeah. others would only follow your lead.
How do we make that happen?
Tin House.
Oh, they're getting there. I think the Vita account was pretty favorable in terms of Tin House, right? They're working on it, aren't they?
Yeah. The thing is, the male female, those who were identify as male and female, it seemed to get better for some. It seemed to get worse for others. And that was kind of the big spotlight. And then, I mean, the racial and gender and other things do need a little bit of work. I mean, the whole breakdown of Asian, Southeast Asian, that got kind of confusing in terms of like, okay, so is East Asian Asian? And then we're not including, you know.
Oh, I know.
What
I know.
About Pacific Islander? You know, just some certain breakdowns were like, this is confusing. So,
right. It is confusing. I mean, I think that the other part of this equation, and you and I have talked about this in a previous conversation, but it's about seeding the pool, right? Mm-hmm. The more people, young people, we have getting into publishing as a career, mm-hmm. The more young people realize that it is a career option, the better off we're all going to be in the future.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, I just did a seminar at my alma mater here in Southern California, which has a wonderful institution called the Center for Writing and Public Discourse. It's Claremont McKenna College. It's a great institution. It typically ranks top 10 liberal arts colleges. It's mm-hmm. very, very expensive to go mm-hmm. to. So we went and we did this seminar on publishing. It was just 2 hours on publishing. And these students, they're not yet aware of two critical things. One, that publishing has a diversity problem, and two, that it's even possible to have a career in publishing. And then, you know, 2A, they're also not aware of what it actually means to have a career in publishing, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll say things like, oh, yes, I'm a published novelist. And I'm like, that's great. Who are you published with? And they're like, oh, I went to Wattpad. And you're like, oh, okay. That's fantastic. Congratulations. But do you actually know what it means to get into the whole big engine that is publishing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So they don't know that. So the more students we can get to understand that, and the more diverse that student body is, I think the better off we all will be mm-hmm. for the publishing future.
Yeah. And you mentioned in terms of reading, you said you don't read the cover letter until you're on the fence, you said?
Yeah, typically that's typically what happens, because I don't, you know, I don't the reason I give is because I don't want to be biased, but that's always a changing equation.
So their names are not on the actual work itself.
I don't specifically read blind. I mean, some of them mm-hmm. Actually there are very few folks that will actually put their name on every page of the publication. Mm-hmm. I just kind of try really hard not to see it.
Because in talking with Amanda with Book Riot, Amanda Nelson, uh-huh. she had mentioned that she was reading stuff blind for Book Riot, and then she would look at the cover letter or their bio and say, ah, it's another 20-year-old white girl. Why am I drawn to this voice? You know, and looking at her reading habits of why is this what I'm drawn to, when I am very much aware that I want to better diversify the industry. However, my reading tastes seem to lean this way.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I can tell you that I am drawn to essays about the outdoors. I'm also drawn to rocky coming of age stories that aren't necessarily tied to the actual age at which you might come of age, mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I'm drawn to inanimate objects. I don't know. I think I've just been really lucky. But you know, we've been attracting a really diverse group of writers, and that makes me really happy.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Awesome. Good to hear that.
So speaking of, you know, let's do the flip side of you as querying author, And on your website, you noted the lengthy process of querying your novel and how many agents. I mean, you broke down the numbers. You said, this is how many people responded. This is how many people I queried. Da, da, da. And it does put things in a very interesting perspective, I think, because I know I've had friends say, I was going to quit after 20 queries. And I said, that's it?
Dude, that is so not enough, friend.
That's it? And then they got an agent at 21, you know? Like, query 21 was the one they got that agent at. And I was like, you were really going to quit after less than 24? You know, I've had friends query 100. You know, because they're like, I don't know. I'm just going to query and see what sticks. So what motivated you to keep going? Because I believe it was, what was the number 85 queried?
Yeah, it was it was 85. Thank you for giving props to that to that number. That's going to be my lucky number from here on in, 85. Yes, it was 85 total agents queried, and I'm sure there were a couple of them that I was just, you know, too distressed to write down on my spreadsheet. I think that I had enough requests for fulls and partials, that is requests to see some of the manuscript or all of the manuscript, that I knew I had something. Also, this was a story that I really wanted to tell. I really wanted to have this voice be out there. I really wanted to have it out there in conjunction with the story that the voice was telling. So I just kind of kept on plugging away at it. But I did make a couple of critical mistakes. One big mistake was in not paying attention to some of the critiques that I was getting from agents who were kind enough to write back to me. And as I mentioned on my website, like the bulk of the rejections were like, oh, I didn't resonate with the voice, or I don't like epistolary novels, but I had a couple that were like, the characters are flat, right? Or I don't sense any forward motion, right? Okay, and those are really important criticisms to keep under your belt, right? Because even if you don't feel like they're worthwhile for this novel, even if you disagree strongly, you're going to keep on being a writer, right? So you may make these mistakes later on. And if a top-notch agent is making these comments at you, then you should probably just keep that in your back pocket and carry it around so that you know that some people are likely to see your writing this way, right? But for me, at the end of the day, late in the querying game, I had a highly regarded agent tell me that I needed 6,000 more words, and then that she also sensed a big hole in the story. So when I fixed that, it ended up selling really fast, and that was a really good sign. That maybe you should listen to people when they tell you things. Maybe. If they come from a big agent house and they kind of know what they're talking about, right?
Yeah. Unless they're using code.
Unless they're
when
using
you're marginalized
code, right?
And like, I just don't connect.
Right. Well, you know, I was talking to somebody else about this, and she said, well, you know, she wanted to know if I sensed any racially sort of motivated criticism behind, you know, behind what the agents were telling me. And I said, well, nobody who isn't going to pick up the book because she thinks it's the wrong voice for an Asian character is ever going to tell you that. You know, they're never going to phrase it that way. They're going to say, I didn't connect with a voice, right? So I don't know if that's even like a thing that you can chart correctly, right? I think it's just one of those things that you sort of have to trust your gut on at the end of the day. You know, say, okay, this is a story that I really want to tell.
So how was the process working with Shade Mountain Press?
It was brilliant. I don't think I ever expected that it would be such a collaborative effort. I think Leland had also mentioned this in the interview that you did with him about what a collaborative effort it actually was. And you know, working with a small press is a beautiful thing because you have input into every different aspect of the publication, right? Typeface, how big the gutter is, what the cover looks like. I mean, in the big five, you almost would never get input, unless you're Mira Jacob, apparently. You would almost never get input into what the cover looks like, right? So that's a really great part of it. Plus, the other part of it, too, is that when we were reaching out for blurbs, I felt really lucky. Like, it was such a pleasure to reach out to these authors. I reached out to a couple, and Rosalie, my publisher, reached out to a couple as well. But this literary community thing that people talk about and bat around, it's a real thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people take time out of their lives to read the book of somebody they've never met before, of a debut author, of somebody they've never even heard of before, and then they take the time to feedback on it. Like, that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, as much as we gripe about the publishing world, like, it has some truly amazing parts to it. So it was really cool to be able to see that firsthand up and, you know, up and close and personal. That was really neat.
Awesome. How are you feeling about it coming out? I mean, by the time this episode posts, it won't be out yet, but
yeah. You know, people can actually buy the book now because my printer was 8 weeks early.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So you can actually buy the book on Shade Mountain Press's website right now. You can also, if you want to, go to Amazon and buy it there if you like. But yeah, it's been kind of a non-waiting period because there are a ton of things you have to do. Like, this weekend I'm giving a keynote talk at Mount San Antonio College, which is one of the greatest community colleges on the planet. So I'm speaking there. I'm lining up some teaching gigs. I'm, you know, making sure that the reviewers who requested the book had the book. And, you know, obviously Rosalie is a big part of that too. So, you know, there's all this sort of like activity that's going back and forth. And part of me kind of wants to be like, gee, I really wish this was a waiting period. But the other part of me is definitely happy that there is stuff to do and not be just like anxiously refreshing my Goodreads page over and over again to see who's picked up the, you know, the giveaway copy or who's requesting it. Because you can make yourself crazy, Jen. I mean,
no, believe me, I'm in forums where I hear this, and it's just funny to hear the And I, you know, I don't want to call people fragile, but it's very interesting when people just sit there and say, "I don't know what to do." And I'm like, really, really, because you can start so making some contacts. You can go to libraries and talk to the librarians and make sure they know you exist. Yeah, there's so much to do, and maybe because working with the smaller press where it's so hands-on, you get kind of thrown into the fire quicker, but also you have that experience from your previous work and current work as well. And I think when someone debuts with the Big Five and like, I'm a writer, sometimes that's not always clear cut in terms of this being a business. And I think people forget that a lot.
Or
that
right.
It's a certain kind of writer who understands that writing is also a business.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a quick anecdote. Okay, so when I was living in Chicago, I lived in a neighborhood that was populated by a reasonable number of college students, and also we were two blocks away from Wrigley Field. Okay, so there were always a lot of late nights going on. All right, it was also a very doggy neighborhood, which meant that people were out walking their dogs at all areas at all like all times of the day. All right, so I would go out with my dog at like 7 a.m, and there was always inevitably some girl out there in her pajamas and Uggs walking her dog. Okay. All right, this made me completely insane because I don't really understand how these people don't understand that every time you step out of your door, you are to a degree marketing yourself. Like in a town, in any major city, the person you run into around the corner of your block could be somebody that I don't know, does something great for you, or it could be your boss, or it could be the secretary of the publishing house that you're trying to get into, or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just this life that we're in, this business that we're in of putting our thoughts and our deepest ruminations on display, like in black and white, in book form for people to read, it is a marketing job. Like, granted, there is something to be said for the quiet time that we spend as writers by ourselves, but nothing gets done if we're not connecting with other people on a regular basis. Other writers, bookstores, folks who are writing book reviews, people who are bloggers. Like, this is such a big, important part of your life. You have to be out there continuously making connections and being friendly to people, and just, you know, putting yourself out there because this is your work. Like, this is something you spent all of your life slaving over, trying to be. Why would you not, to borrow a phrase I heard from a bookseller at AWP this year, like, why would you not do honor to that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just kind of what it is, right? So you should be writing blog posts, and you should be connecting with people who can let you guest blog or whichever. And by the way, that's completely separate from my edict of like getting paid for your work. That's very important. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you're marketing yourself and you're out there, eventually that will feed back into book sales, and that's just mm-hmm. that's just important.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm done ranting now. Sorry.
Well, I agree that there's more to it than. Now I have a book published and my publisher will do all the work and I'll sit here and I'll write the next book. Because I think writing is 90% of it. Obviously, you wouldn't be here if you didn't write something and right. someone didn't enjoy it and so on and so forth. But the fact is, people need to know you exist. And, you know, I understand that networking isn't everyone's forte. However, I do think there's certain connections, like librarians and booksellers and book reviewers, like you say, that need to be made. And in talking to people who are published at Big Fives, who work at Big Fives, or who work at small presses like mine, where it's about 24 people, your publisher will not always do that. They will not have the capability. Someone's lazy. This is true. I know it for a fact. Lazy people work in publishing. This is true. And you know, someone's pissed. Someone's just started. Someone doesn't know. Someone's just using the job as a... I mean, there's so many variables. You're not always going to have this super perfect team of warm fuzzies and everyone's absolutely concrete good at their job. I mean, I think this happens a lot in terms of having good people, but also having overworked people, understanding your publicist is not your specific publicist. God forbid if you share your publicist with Joyce Carol Oates or something. You
right.
know?
Yeah. Right.
So I just think there are elements to it that people don't always get, that it's about the work. It's about being true to your work and growing as an artist, but it is a business.
I mean, the other part of it too, Jen, I mean, especially given everything you've just said, is that this book is not going to be your only book, okay? This mm-hmm. publishing house is not going to be your only publishing house. So if you are depending on your publishing house to do everything for you, then that means that you're not laying tracks towards your second book. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problem. You know, you always want to be looking for your second book, and you always want it to be figuring out what your next step is going to be. Like, you want a career in writing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to be one-hit wonder.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Jimmy Eat World, I think.
Throwback.
I know, right? Well, I was gonna throw Chesney Hawks at you, but I think that might be a UK thing.
Mighty Boss Tones count? And like,
no, they had at least 5 hits. Jen, come on, give me a break.
Yeah, okay, my bad. I'm thinking right. maybe like that woman who did Freak Like Me. I forget her name. So may we talk about the misadventures of Marty Wu?
Yes, please. I'm so glad it's out in the world, and I'm so glad that you've noticed it.
It's a symbolic cover I noticed as well.
Oh yeah, the sharp little scissors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My Rosalie actually pointed that out as being a dual symbolism, right? I mean, she wants to move forward, and yet she's enduring all these tiny little cuts mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. corners unknown, as it were. Yeah.
Funny because a writer I admire, and she actually said this recently at a interview she did, and break it down, it's when you write nonfiction, people want to know what part of it is made up, and then when you write fiction, people want to know what to attribute as biographical.
Right.
So with Not a Self-Help Book, The Misadventures of Marty Wu, the content, namely the protagonist, I imagine you as a woman of color are going to be asked, if you haven't already, is this autobiographical? In this regard, where did the story come from and what elements, if any, may have been taken, not necessarily from your life, but from what you've seen or experienced or what you don't see enough in books featuring people of color?
Okay. That's a really, really good question. Okay, so I did work in advertising, mm-hmm. Every time I went out to a concert with my client, or every time I went to a whiskey tasting with a client, I did always wonder what my mom thought of my job. Like, I was pretty sure that she had no idea how to describe this to her friends. Mm-hmm. And I was also pretty sure that that was causing her an undue amount of agita. And I knew this because she would tell me, right? It's not like it was a secret or anything. It's not like I'm like some incredible diviner, you know, where I'm like reading my mom's mind or anything to that effect. No, she would tell me. She's an outspoken, bright woman. But the reality was that I also knew that there were other women like me, other young women like me, who wanted to pursue careers that were kind of outside the fold of what their parents knew, right? Mm-hmm. And I wondered what it would be like for somebody if this character had chosen to stay close to home and, you know, near the cause of a lot of the insecurity and a lot of the pain. Mm. The story is drawn from partially from what I know and partially from what I know of other women's lives. The voice is drawn from what I imagined the perfect paragon of, you know, daughterhood would say if she were allowed to say all the things that were sort of fomenting around her on the inside. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's part imagination and part real life. I think that probably one of my tenets is always that all fiction to some level is drawn from true life, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we gain our inspirations, by eavesdropping.
Yes.
So certainly there's a certain amount of truth in it. It's more emotional truth than it is anything else. You know, it's about what we wish we could have said and about sort of what we wish we would have done when the opportunity presented itself more than anything else. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, I really wanted to write an American story. And it was creepy listening to Leland last week because it's pretty much what he said as well. You know, this is an American story. It's a story about like finding your own manifest destiny, as it were, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's just a book about a girl who's trying to find a job. But it happens to be told in her own unique voice. And I think that's what we look for when we look for great writing, is to find a voice that you can identify with, but who will also teach you something new.
Yeah. And I also noticed the parallels mainly with the seeking redemption with the parent angle.
Yeah.
So I was also wondering in that regard, because it starts off with that conflict pretty immediate.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like basically the first line, if not most of the first page.
Right, right.
As, ugh, my mother called me.
Right. Right. Well, which one of us hasn't had that moment, right? I mean, I dare you. Show me the girl that hasn't had that moment. You know, particularly when you're trying to get out the door to a hot date or whatever, and you're wearing something really skimpy and your mom calls and like suddenly your cheeks go bright a bloom, even though she can't see you wearing terrible skimpy dress, right? I mean, your moms have this weird sense of timing. They kind of know when to call it exactly the wrong or the right moment, depending. I think the redemption, the parental redemption thread is quite common and also quite quite American.
Yes.
We all want to do, you know what, I'm rethinking this because I'm thinking about how every parent, I believe from what I know, and I am not a parent, but every parent from what I know wants to see their child do as well or better than they did. And I think that's particularly true in immigrant families, from what I've seen. The question is how to define that, right? I mean, how do you scale better than? What does that mean exactly, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really up to each individual character to define for themselves whether or not they can live with somebody else's definition of better than or good enough.
Yeah, yeah. And also it fits with being with Shade Mountain Press, being a feminist publisher, and the storytelling of how Marty's treated by her coworkers, namely men,
right.
In this kind of boys club. And you mentioned going out for the whiskey and kind of trying to adapt to your customers' needs or potential customers' needs, anticipate what they want. And it's, feels very frat boyish in a way.
Yeah.
You know, even though
sales
you're... Oh my goodness, couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Say it right now.
Sales, I'll tell you what, I think part of the reason that I'm so in love with the brown liquor at this point in time in my life is expressly due to my time in sales. I really believe that. I really, really believe that. For a long time, my parents used to trot me out like as a party trick. Like, oh, she can drink. Yeah, she can drink. You know, it's kind of like when I was 8, it was like, oh, she can play the piano. And now it's like, yeah, she can drink. You know, oh, boy, she can drink. But yeah, it definitely has this sort of frat boy behavior. And that's, I think, the other part of the story I wanted to tell. Like, you know, what is it like to be a young woman who's in this world? Mm-hmm. It's not quite Wall Street, right? But there definitely is this sort of atmosphere of, you know, hard partying, out all night for the sake of your clients, and then up the next morning for another client meeting, right?
Yeah, put up or shut up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all very competitive, right? I mean, I definitely remember, I will tell you, I definitely remember being out until 3 a.m. with clients and then rolling in the next morning and having to catch a nap at my desk. There's no question about that. It has happened.
Man.
Oh, not anymore. Not anymore. My body does not do that anymore.
Yeah. No spoilers on that for the book, though.
Yeah, no spoilers.
Whether that remains a part of Marty's life or not.
Exactly, exactly. Let's just see. You'll have to read the book to find out, right?
Yes, and it's available. So there you go.
It's available. Yes, it is.
So what are you working on next? Are you working on anything next? Is that a dangerous question to ask?
I am. I have a second novel that I'm really excited about. It involves time travel and some great explorers, so I'm super excited about that. It does take place fully in America, so, well, except for some express parts in between. But yeah, it's another American Express story about finding yourself. But it's I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be really, really, really fun.
That's so interesting. I was talking to someone at a reading, and they were saying, and I kind of agree with them too, is sometimes our first full-fledged works tend to be the most personal and, you know, the write what you know,
yeah,
kind of tactic that you always hear. And so that's what a lot of debuts tend to do. It's like, I know this, so I'm going to write this. And that was kind of the case with Mira and Leland and Sophia as well. And even with my work, it tends to be, and then I'm like, that next book is going to be ridiculous. Like, I'm going to talk about the 1800s. It's going to be wild.
Okay, so let me ask you this though, Jen. Do you think it's about write what you know, or do you think it's like write about the albatross that's on your chest that you have to get rid of before you can write about anything else?
That makes a lot of sense too. Yeah.
Like, I mean, for me, it's kind of like, this is the story I have to tell because in writing the story, I will also know myself a little bit more. Right. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm done with that, then I can feel, some confidence in knowing myself, but also I can feel confident as a writer knowing that I've told the story that's closest to me and therefore hardest to tell. So now I can tell somebody else's story to a degree. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I really think there is something to this sort of, it's somewhere between write what you know and, you know, let me get this off my chest. Right. Mm-hmm. I was literally just talking to my co-editor at Tahoma Literary Review about this. And, you know, like Leland, I wrote the book to entertain. Like that was my primary mission. Joe said, I think there's something else to it. I think that you are either intentionally or unintentionally, you are making a statement about the way that folks see diverse literature. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, maybe, except maybe the statement I'm making isn't so much like, you know, diverse literature needs to have more eyeballs on it, but it's more like the 1.5 generation, this generation of immigrants that we're looking at, the one that I belong to, right? Mm-hmm. Where my parents immigrated and I grew up here, has a voice that is its own. It is neither 100% immigrant nor 100% American, right? Mm-hmm, So what does it look like to be stuck in those worlds? What does it look like to have one foot in each culture, and what does it feel like to not belong? And if that voice is making a statement, then I think that's okay. I mean, it's not, maybe it's not intended, but I think it's all right to have that out there. And I think it's probably a good thing to have that out there.
Mm-hmm. And like Leland, both of the mothers are a trip.
That's true. Mm-hmm. They are. Leland's mother in Celebra Pong is a real trip. She is an absolute doozy, isn't she?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. So is Marty. I don't want to do it on a scale of Claire Huxtable to Mommy Dearest. How bad is your literary mother?
Oh, my God. This is so a bustle column. It's so newspaper form. Somebody out there who's listening to this, write this column for Mother's Day, because it is completely worthwhile, I'm telling you.
They totally love their listicles, people. They love their listicles.
Absolutely.
Well, Yisha, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your wisdom and talking up Not a Self-Help Book. I'm going to plug it one more time. Shade Mountain Press. And it is the feature book. It's at the very top of the page.
Thank you so much for having me, Jen. It is such a pleasure to be a part of this really important podcast. I'm so glad that it exists and that you exist and all the work you've done. So thanks a lot for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much. So how may people get in contact with you?
So you can find me on Twitter at Good Dirt. That's two D's, because otherwise it would be Goo Dirt. That's just straight. And you can also find me on the web at thegooddirt.org. You can order the book via Shade Mountain Press or via Amazon.
And is it actually, I should ask, I should have checked. Yeah. Is it going to be available as an ebook on Amazon?
Yes. In fact, it is available right now as a Kindle edition. Right now, it just is for some reason not linked to the actual page itself, but you can find it for sure.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, and by the way, just a little funny note. I noticed that if you Google Not a Self-Help Book, you come up with all sorts of self-help books. But if you Google Marty Wu, it comes up right away. So Google that first.
And that's Marty Wu, W-U. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
With authority.
Well, I always want people to buy and read the books. So at the very least, ask your library to stock them, because that helps.
Ask
too.
Ask your library, or go to your local bookstore. All Shade Mountain books are distributed by small press distributors, and everybody has access to that. So go to your local bookstore and ask them to carry the book. You know, every book by Shade Mountain is an incredible book, and there are lots and lots and lots of really deserving small presses out there. So if you find them, do your best to go to local bookstore and make sure that they're aware of these small presses, because they're doing great work.
They are, and they're making really good product.
Thank you.
They look good. I judge a book by its cover.
Me too.
and copy book cover. Well, thank you again, Yishun, for being on. And
thank you.
Listeners, do follow her on Twitter and go to thegooddirt.org. If you click, she has very clear on the homepage, she has a link to her process and how everything went down and the numbers in that blog post that we talked about, where how many people she queried and what she learned. And that is on her website if you want to see the full breakdown. And it's done in very digestible chunks. So I would highly recommend it, especially if you're feeling down and you got your 20 rejections. Maybe read that.
It's 20? Oh my gosh, it's killing me here, Jen. Christ down.
People tell me this, and I'm like, okay. Okay. It's not that I don't feel sorry for you or feel bad. It's just that it's like, many ways to go, my friend.
Exactly.
And the next guest on the podcast will be writer and illustrator Mary Naomi, who I'm also super excited to have on because I'm a big fan of her work. And we're just talking about illustrations and writers. So, yeah, another one on the podcast. So thanks again for listening. And as I already said at the top of the episode, you can follow Minorities in Publishing at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at Minorities in Pub. Oh, thanks again.